Research Limited and Batch Care. And next to me I have Mr. Mark Crisp, Cook Batch and Batch Care's planning expert. And sitting behind me I have two client representatives, Ms. Leslie Preston, who's the founder and managing director of Batch Care, and Mr. Peter Miles, who's the founder and general manager of Cook Batch and Home Away New Zealand. Mr. Miles, Peter Miles.
Ms.
Leslie Preston.
Preston, thank you.
So, sir, in addition to Cook Batch's submissions and Batch Care's submissions, you should have a copy of pre-lodged evidence from Mr. Crisp, dated 6 August.
Yes.
And also legal submissions which were lodged on Friday afternoon with a case called with two cases in it.
Yes.
So on the basis that you've read the evidence and the submissions, we've prepared both each a summary of legal submissions and also a summary of evidence which we will hand out to the public. As the panel will be aware, Mr. Chairman, since the filing of Cook Batch's submissions, the Council has filed a memo late on Friday afternoon responding to a number of questions that were put to the Council witnesses. So the way that we've approached this is that the second part of Mr. Crisp's summary actually provides comments on those 10 matters. So we would be happy to answer questions either individually or collectively, and Ms. Preston and Mr. Miles are also happy to answer any questions if you have any issues in relation to their operations. So the panel will be aware from the legal submissions that Cook Batch and Batch Care are potentially seeking alternative relief. The first is the subzone approach outlined in the submissions, and the provisions that are sought in relation to the subzone approach are attached to the original submissions. I'm happy to provide further copies of the submissions if they're not readily accessible at the panel.
They aren't actually readily accessible on the website. I was looking last night. So, especially I was looking for some maps.
Yes, that's correct.
Yes, and I couldn't access them on the website. So, if you have that, it'd be helpful. Thank you very much.
So, the submissions are virtually identical in substance. This is the Batch Care version. And you'll see in the annexures the provisions that relate to the subzone approach and also the maps that show the subzone areas. Shown on page 49.
subzone boundaries are the ones surrounded by red on those maps.
That's correct. The alternative approach that Brook Batch and Batch Care have proposed in the submissions is more simplified approach, if you like, Mr. Chairman. That would just involve a 90-day limit for permitted activity for residential visitor accommodation, and where the permitted activity standards breach, that would default to restricted discretionary activity across the district. And also, it would be a reversion back to the registration of holiday homes and homestays as per the operative district plan. Given that there's been a number of renditions or versions of the council provisions, we haven't attempted to update those by marked up changes, as it really is just a question of suitable matters of discretion to the RDA across the district, changing the numbers proposed by Ms. Bovies from 42 to 90 in terms of the permitted activity threshold.
And do I take it from that approval suggesting that the people using the 90-day option would be registered?
That's correct.
Yes.
And from Booker Batch and Batch Care's perspective, that would certainly help in terms of monitoring and enforcement issues to have a registration approach. So turning now to the summary of the legal submissions. These set out the key points that I would wish to highlight from the legal submissions. The first is that residential visitor accommodation in the district contributes to the choice of visitor accommodation and has a range of benefits. And these benefits are discussed in the evidence of the party's witnesses, including Mr. Hayes on behalf of the council, who has highlighted that residential visitor accommodation does help to cater for the growth in tourism that the district is experiencing, and it also provides a source of revenue to the businesses who service the properties as well as the hosts. The justification for the council's proposed residential visitor accommodation provisions, which are more restrictive than those in the operative plan and more restrictive than those for homestays, is based on the perceived effects of these activities on residential character, cohesion and amenity, and housing availability and affordability. However, it is submitted that neither the council section 32 report or Ms. Bovies' planning evidence establish that the existing operative plan rules are resulting in adverse effects on residential character, cohesion and amenity. And just picking up there on the point that's raised in the legal submission, Ms. Bovies does appear to largely rely for her view on these issues on the discussion in the council section 32 report. However, the section 32 report itself acknowledges that despite the growth in visitor accommodation that has been experienced in the last 10 years, there is no clear evidence that the existing operative plan residential visitor accommodation activities are having adverse effects on things such as parking, availability, noise or other issues that can be distinguished from otherwise ordinary residential activities. Turning now to Mr. Hayes' economic evidence, this does not establish that there is any quantifiable link between residential visitor accommodation activities and housing availability in the district. Mr. Hayes' evidence rightly recognises that properties such as holiday homes are not part of the long-term rental market, and his evidence and my submission supports the view that 90 nights a year is the appropriate threshold for permitted residential visitor activities. And I'd just like to add there, Sue, that if Mr. Hayes is of the opinion that restricting visitor accommodation to less than 90 nights a year will probably result in long-term rental becoming a more lucrative option for summer hosts, whose motivation is no evidence that the existing 99 approach is having residential amenity and cohesion effects. There is simply no effects-based justification for the more restrictive 42-night permitted activity threshold for residential visitor accommodation that is currently being proposed by the council. Further, it is submitted that there is no evidence from the council's witnesses to justify differences in treatment between residential visitor accommodation and homestay activities. And I'd just like to point out still to the panel that this is an issue of real concern to Book Batch and Batch Care, because as set out in the legal submissions, there is no evidence at all before the panel about the potential economic effects of homestay activities and what impact they may be having on housing availability. In addition, Ms. Bovai's evidence contains no detailed analysis of this issue. In essence, there is no recognition in the council's approach that the main difference between the two activities is that with one, there is a host on site. And if anything, it could be argued that with the comings and goings, 365 nights a year from homestay activities, that the potential effects on residential amenity could in fact be greater than those of a single household short-term renting a holiday home. Turning now to point six in my summary of submissions. It is submitted that the potential effects of concern to the council are all capable of being addressed in standards and matters of discretion and assessment criteria for restricted discretionary activities where those standards are breached. And Mr. Crisp will address this issue further in his statement. However, it is submitted that it is clear from the evolving nature of Ms. Bovey's proposed provisions that breaches of permitted activity standards for residential visitor accommodation could easily be addressed as restricted discretionary activities across the district, especially now that she is proposing controlled activities as the activity status for breaches in the rural zone serve. I've referred very briefly in paragraph 7 to the case law, and I'd be happy to take you through the case law if that would be assistance, but the key points are that recent decisions, including that of His Honour Judge Patrick in the Royal Forest and Brood Protection Society in Whakatane District 2017 decision, supports a less restrictive regime being adopted where the purpose of the RMA and the objectives of the plan can be met by a less restrictive regime. And the case law also highlights the risk of acting in an arbitrary manner over a large area of the district where there is a lack of information about the impact of the proposed rules. And that is what Book of Batch and Batch Care say is directly the situation here. A key principle that comes out of these decisions is that land use activity should only be restricted where that is necessary and there is evidence in support of the restriction, which is certainly not the case here in relation to residential visitor accommodation activities. Given the evidence and the case law, Book of Batch and Batch Care's less restrictive alternative options better meet the applicable statutory criteria. It is submitted that plan provisions with a 99 permitted activity threshold that provide for the registration of residential visitor accommodation and homestays will enable an efficient use of the district's housing stock that would otherwise be empty for much of the year. And that's another point that Mr. Crisp will pick up on in his summary. Finally, the lack of evidence about the effects of residential visitor accommodation and homestay activities means that non-complying activity status when permitted activity standards are breached cannot be justified.
restricted discretionary activity status provides the appropriate mechanism to assess the merits of individual applications on a case-by-case basis. And it is submitted there that that is the appropriate approach until the council actually properly understands and has evidence about the actual effects of residential visitor accommodation and homestay activities in the district.
Do I take from the summary that the alternative relief is now the preferred relief?
Yes, that is the case.
Thank you. Just wanted to clarify that, otherwise I would spend a lot of time questioning the, where the lines were drawn on the map. And any questions I have about where the lines are on the map, we should go to the cross by table. Anyone else have any legal questions before we get on to?
Well, just can I just clarify that from your client's point of view, they're seeking to treat homestays and residential visitor accommodation in exactly the same way. In other words, have the 90-day limit apply to both?
Yes, correct.
My legal question is about the ability of restrictive discretionary, which you're proposing instead of non-complying, and we've got discretionary in between those two, the ability of restrictive discretionary to address cumulative effects. Because we've heard concerns about multiple the RBAs in one street, for example, all going for 365 days a year applications under, in your case, restricted discretionary activity status, such that the majority of the street starts to become accommodation all year round rather than a mix. I'm interested in what the case law says or the legal situation is about the ability of restricted discretionary to enable that to be addressed in a cumulative sense.
Well, Commissioner, I'm certainly aware of other plans that do include as matters of discretion cumulative effects, and I could see how in a scenario such as that you've described, that you get a situation that, say, a quarter of a street starts to become residential visitor accommodation and starts to become consumed for whatever reason, that you could, with a restricted discretionary activity approach, include cumulative effects as being one of the matters of discretion and assessment criteria, and carefully craft the assessment criteria to reflect the particular concern. So in the scenario you've described, I wouldn't see it as being something that couldn't be included as part of a restricted discretionary activity, matter of discretion.
But it would require careful crafting of the assessment matters or matters of discretion anyway, and potentially a policy basis for that as well.
Potentially, but the plan that I'm thinking of actually just has cumulative effects in relation to, and you can specify the matters of concern, or you can have cumulative effects in relation to the previous matters. If you've identified, for example, parking, those sorts of things, housing availability. So I wouldn't see any difficulty with the circumstances that you described.
I also like to ask Mr. Chris to say from a practical point of view, both in the application and the drafting. Thank you. That's good.
Just, I think it's probably a legal question. One of the cornerstones of the council's case appears to be that RVA is a non-residential activity. Looking at your submissions, I take it that's not your view. That's really kind of what the difference is.
Well, I think the way we've pitched it is that a 90-day restriction
is still ensuring that the predominant activity that's occurring is, because it's only a quarter of a year effectively, is still a residential activity. So what obviously had the commercial aspect to it, the predominant activity that's occurring is a residential activity. But obviously the difficulty with homestay activities is that at the moment that can occur 365 days per year, whereas arguably that is less of a residential activity because of the lesser, if you like, restrictions on how it may occur.
Yes, so what you're telling me here is that if you go beyond a certain threshold number of days, or 90, then that would make it effectively transition from being a residential activity because of subsidiary into being a non-residential activity because the accommodation aspect is becoming too dominant. Is that basically what you're saying?
Yes, potentially that's the argument. And I think one of the things that we've got to with the 90 days, it supported by Mr. Hayes' evidence, because that's the point at which he says that it may become more attractive to switch to long-term rental accommodation, a lower threshold. And secondly, it's our position that there are no adverse residential character, cohesion and amenity effects resulting from the current 90-day limit in the operating plan. So that's how we've arrived at that number. Whereas our view is that the council number is much more arbitrary.
That's why I come back for the 90 days, probably the minutes of Christmas a bit later. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll just read through my summary and two in terms of some of those issues that you've already raised. So the submissions by Booker Batch and Batch Care stated concerns that in terms of the strategic objectives of the district plan, the notified provisions drew an artificial distinction between homestay accommodation and residential based visitor accommodation for the home reading short study, assumed without an evidential basis that restrictions on short-term rental could facilitate a switch to long-term rental for residential occupancy, and did not effectively address the amenity issues arising from multi-party occupancy. While I support the increased flexibility in the Section 42A report recommendations regarding the permitted length of stay in residential visitor accommodation being extended to 42 days per year across all zones, my evidence explains why further amendments are required to achieve the sustainable management of resources. My evidence explains the changes that are, in my opinion, needed, and I have undertaken a further evaluation of these proposed amendments under Section 32AA of the Act, which I summarise in my evidence. Any actual or potential effects on residential amenity can be addressed by way of appropriate definitions and performance standards relating to the range of visitor accommodation that is expected to be provided. Where performance standards are not able to be achieved, a resource consent application as a restricted discretionary activity guided by relevant assessment criteria can and should clearly establish the matters that are to be addressed. The amendment of the definitions, rules and assessment criteria that I have outlined in my evidence would ensure that the effects associated with RVA and homestays, whether they are permitted or specifically consented, would be mostly indiscernible from that of a typical residential dwelling. So I just sort of note that response to the question by Commissioner Mixer, is that if me and my family are staying in a batch in Queenstown, how would anyone know whether we own that batch or we're renting it for a short stay in terms of the effects that you would experience on the environment? In my opinion, and I've done that, and I've stayed for you, but they would be indiscernible. You wouldn't know. And if anything, the requirements on people who are using Batch Care facilities, because there's a bond, things like that, if anything, there's a greater incentive to not have parties and to not misbehave and not to cause any disruption to your neighbours. We were So as such, they will be consistent with the objectives for the respective residential zones, which seek to ensure that residential character is maintained. A house that is occupied is more consistent with residential character than one that is empty for more of the time due to restrictions of the number of days that can be used by short-stay occupants. So I think that's a really important point about if your overall objective is maintaining residential amenity, having streets of houses that are unoccupied, in my view, is providing less of a residential character than having houses that are occupied more of the time, irrespective of their zone. A house that is occupied, for similar reasons, I support the alternative relief proposed by Booker Batch and Batch Care of enabling RVA and homestays to be permitted up to 90 days per year, with the ability to apply for a restricted discretionary total resource consent where permitted activity standards are breached. And so that would be a very simple exercise of just changing, in terms of the changes that are applied to the plans, just change the number from 42 to 90, make the consequence of non-compliance with any of the performance standards give rise to restricted discretionary activity status. And one of the obvious matters of assessment is the effects on the environment as a result of the non-compliance with relevant performance standards that are breached. So whether that's the number of people or number of days per year or whatever it might be that's breached. Anticipated visitor growth is a significant component of the district's growth projections. Accommodation for short-term rental is clearly an essential resource that needs to be available in order to sustain the operation and growth of the tourism economy. RVA aids dispersal across the district, including Wanaka and rural areas. In many cases, RVA is the preferred choice for families and groups who seek self-contained, self-catering accommodation. This is especially the case for domestic travellers who know and feel comfortable with getting around the area. I recognise the appropriateness of provisions that will improve the supply of dwellings to meet local needs, but I do not consider that it is appropriate for this to be achieved, nor do I consider that it will be achieved through a restriction on other forms of occupancy which clearly form part of the projected requirements. Owning a batch and owning rental properties are two very different investment propositions with different objectives. So I can say that because I'm in both camps myself. Renting out a batch for long-term rental accommodation defeats the primary purpose for which it was purchased, that is, to be able to periodically use it yourself whenever you want to. There is no evidence that restrictions on RVA will result in an increase in the availability of houses for long-term accommodation. The only certain outcome associated with such restrictions is that batches will stay empty for longer periods of time and not be available to meet the projected increase in demand for short-stay accommodation. So allowing a batch to be used for short-stay accommodation by people other than the owners represents a more efficient use of resources compared to their house being otherwise empty. And so I'm not an economist, but I have done economics to university at university. And just one of the most basic sort of tenets of economics is that if you, in a situation where you have high demand, if you shorten up the supply, all you're going to do is push out the price. And so what you do, if you did that, all you do is provide an incentive for people to utilise actual batch care and not and decrease any comparative benefit of having it as a long-term rental, leaving aside the issues I was talking about. So just really from an economics point of view, the restriction on the supply is going to have the opposite outcome to that which the planners are seeking. Restricting an activity to the equivalent financial return of a medium income, that is the 42-day per year limit, is not a sound rationale for proposed planning provisions. If there is to be a limit on RVA, then 90 days is more appropriate. Failure to comply with any performance standards should result in restricted discretionary activity application being required, including that number of days. So, Sue, I'll just quickly respond to each of the 10 points in the memorandum filed at 5 o'clock on last Friday. So just using the same numbers of the questions that are in the memo. I've answered the questions in a way that refers to the contents of the questions, so hopefully you don't have to look back or something else. So I agree with Ms. Bowles that the regulation of RBA via the district plan is a legitimate function of council under the RMA. However, there is no evidence that the proposed restrictions on RBA will have any effect on affordability of housing or the availability of long-term rental accommodation. I agree with Ms. Bowles that while they can often have similar effects, homestays and home occupations are sufficiently different such that they should be each be the subject of specific rules related to each activity rather than homestays being a subset of home occupations. In terms of the third question, I agree with Ms. Bowles that that it is appropriate to remove any repetition between objectives 7.28 and 7.29. No amended wording has yet been proposed. It's apparently been the subject of evidence. I also agree with Ms. Bowles that the registration is both possible and a desirable approach for RBA and homestay activities. I also agree with her that such a requirement should sit within the rules that relate to RBA and homestays. As stated in the summary of my evidence, it's my opinion that failure to comply with performance standards relating to RBA or homestays should result in the need for a restrictive discretionary activity and resource consent application anywhere in the district. It is excessively heavy-handed for a minor breach of a performance standard to result in a non-compliant activity status. I consider that the latter should be used for activities that are not generally contemplated in a particular zone, which is not the case in relation to RBA and homestays in the Queenstown Lakes District, being one of the most popular tourism destinations in the country. In my opinion, there is no resource management justification based on environmental effects that would result in a different consent status for RBA and homestays associated with a failure to comply with one or more important standards. As my opinion, in terms of question six, there is, in my opinion, a basis for more lenient provisions relating to RBA and homestays in the rural environment compared to the urban environment. This is largely due to the lesser density of development and associated greater distance between the neighbouring activities, whereby there is a less potential for any off-site effects whatsoever on neighbours such as traffic generation and noise. In answering this question, Ms. Bowboy seeks to retain the 42-day per year restriction, which for reasons stated in my evidence I do not agree with. As previously noted, if there is to be a limit on RBA homestays, then 90 days per year is more appropriate. In terms of question seven, I support the increased flexibility proposed by Ms. Bowboy's in relation to the Millbrook zone, including allowing RBA homestays for up to 179 days per year. The same approach, albeit to a lesser extent, as the 90 days per year is appropriate elsewhere in the district. I have no view or preference in whether the inclusion of RBA activities in the structure plan provisions would be a more appropriate method for providing RBA activities in the Chance Point zone. I have no comment on the evidence regarding the current district accommodation fee numbers. And finally, in the absence of any evidence that RBA and homestays are having any effect on housing affordability and availability of long-term rental accommodation, the extensive list of non-RMA initiatives set out in paragraph 10.9 of the memorandum provided by Mr. Hayes would suggest that there are many other solutions to address the issues at hand and which are far more likely to be effective in achieving the desired outcomes.
About the subzoning approach, but I guess I should ask you, even if your clients have moved away from that as the preferred approach, it's still in your submission. We've had question and exchange about this before here, and one of the statements that's come to mind is a sort of two-tiered approach to the low-density residential zone, where new areas, as yet undeveloped, which seem to be where most of your subzone is, would have a certain level of amenity in relation to the visitor accommodation, and the older areas would have a different level of expectation. But at the same time, we've had people come along and give us a lot of evidence about the new residential areas and how the cost of building and the cost of living and the huge mortgages, and how the only reason they can afford to be in those areas is where they have some form of residential visitor accommodation as part of their package. And how have you decided to differentiate one from the other? And are you suggesting that older areas like Vernon Hill or parts of Wanaka should sort of be sacrificed or have a certain level of amenity and these other areas not have the opportunities that's available for RPA?
I guess the first point is that these rules will only actually apply to new activities, so people doing new things.
Yeah,
so
yes.
All those that are out there doing it now actually have an existing use right.
Yes.
So that's essentially your starting point. And I guess the distinction was based on if the council was wanting to introduce a new regime, then where it applies to new areas, if people have got forewarning that this is now the rules that are going to apply to them, because they're going to be startups, they're not going to be existing operations, then they're going into it with their eyes wide open type of thing. Where, as opposed to restricting people that are, like you say, if someone has already bought a house, got a big mortgage, is utilising the services of Booking Badge or Badge Care or Airbnb or whatever to help pay for that, they've done that on the basis of the old rules, not on the basis of the old more restrictive regime.
But that opportunity wouldn't be available to someone, exactly the same person, in the next suburb to be developed. Mm. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, it was a case of trying to navigate between the various imperatives, if you like. And that's where part of the reason that we've gone for more of the straight 90 days is it cuts away from that sort of distinction. Effectively is the line of least resistance. It's a method that's worked in the old plan. It's a method that's still proposed in the proposed plan. The argument is just over the number. So if we focus on the that works, so let's continue that way, it's you're observing, it's a far more simpler way of advancing things. Everyone knows where it's standing.
Feel free to chip in.
Yeah, can I just add to that? We put quite a bit of work into that submission, and I guess partly what it was about was trying to see the region through a tourism lens as well as a kind of planning lens. And the philosophy around it was that we wanted to preserve the unique traveller experiences that this kind of accommodation provides, and the fact that it provides it across the district. But balance that with council's need to be able to develop new housing areas that were primarily residential. And so that's kind of how we came up with the idea of a sub-zone overlay way of controlling that, is that it would basically balance both purposes. So you have the sub-zones which really protect suburban character, and you have outside of that you've got a more permitted regime.
It's sort of like a rationing or balancing system. One of them was like, well, okay, you areas are this, and your over areas over this are that. Whereas the alternative is more, well, all areas treated the same, but with a limit, and then beyond that,
you get a resource consent
when the suitability of the area is something to take into account.
And a lot of that effect on amenity and whether you're raising more about human effects depends on the capability of each individual property to actually contain this effect.
That's right.
So do they have adequate parking? And one of the things that we've sort of noted is that, like a homestay, even under the rules the council's proposing, a limit of three people, with a homestay, you typically have each room will be occupied by different people, different families. So you'll have at least three cars. Three people per night. Whereas if you've got a whole home with one family, there's a tripling of the traffic generation associated with a homestead compared to a whole of home operation. And so, you know, so then comes back to, well, making sure that as part of the formal standards that there is adequate parking on site, so you don't have it spilling off the site, and causing streetscape effects.
So are you suggesting additional parking requirements? Or bespoke parking requirements?
Whether there should be adequate.
For RBA and homestay.
Yes, there should be adequate. Like for example, you have with your home occupation laws, for example, there is a limit on the number of people movements, and there's requirements for parking and all that. So that would be, that should be.
Something similar. All right. The registration idea, which you supported, how do you envisage that being required under the less than 90 days of potentially committed activity approach?
In terms of that is it's probably just through a portal on the council website.
Outside of the district plan.
Well, it can be a performance standard of the permitted activity that you have to register. That's one thing. And the existing plan has that registration system in place. So
I think it's part of the definition.
Yes,
definition. But are you suggesting that it could appropriately be a standard?
Yes.
That the registration is required, and then the mechanism is done somehow or other, but it's...
Example I was thinking about before, about examples. There is a situation, for example, in the Waikato region where if you are a shallow bore owner, like in Taupo, for example, you've got a geothermal bore for your spa, they remain permitted activities as subject to registering by a certain date. Well, that was because of a historical situation. But in this case, if you want to operate under that permitted activity rule, you then register. That gives the council the information to know how many people are out there are doing it. It could even morph into, at the end of each year, you might have to provide a confirmation that these are the number of nights or whatever, or it provides an opportunity to who to approach in terms of the auditing of committed activity status.
Well, that's going to be my next question. Is that also a possible matter that could be addressed through a standard?
You keep records and you provide an annual summary, which is just a number or at least the dates I have people staying.
Another matter that people sort of have put to us as being sort of fundamentals are things like fire, adequate fire control standards, sort of health and safety type issues that may or may not be picked up in the building consents where there are older existing buildings involved. I mean, do you have any suggestions along those lines?
There's some features that our platform is providing in that area as well to remind owners that they're obligated to have smoke alarm tests and things like that.
Yes, because we can't rely on everybody being on one of the platforms.
Right.
So as Badger, as a management company, we provide health and safety audits, for example, on all of our properties as a requirement of listing and staying with Badger. We do annual audits. There's no reason why that couldn't be standard as required of all people that are registering.
If you look at Section 12A of the Appendix 12 of the operative district plan, there are standards in there, and they include matters relating to fire, obviously smoke alarms, and all that. There's a requirement to maintain records of auditing, ensure compliance with the rules and regulations that'll include your fire and so forth. Install and maintain smoke alarms in accordance with the following, and that sets all that out. Ensure that windmills or fireplaces comply with the building code, things like that. So,
could you move over to that number again, sir?
This is Appendix 12 of the operative plan.
Thank you.
And that's for. That's for just holiday home, just homestays, so applies to both.
So what was it again?
This is Appendix 12 of the operative plan.
So page A12-1.
That's amazing. Oh, right. Now, just on another much more specific topic, in your evidence on paragraphs 617 and 618, you've raised some concerns about the intermeshing, I suppose, of the objectives and policies and the definition of residential activity. Now, I don't know if that's still a concern, if your clients are going for the alternative option. But I just want to make sure I understood what you were saying there properly.
In 617 and 618?
Yes, in 617 and 618. We're talking about things being predominantly used for residential activities to ensure that residential character is maintained.
Yeah.
But then you have a concern that the definition of residential activity doesn't really do that.
Yeah.
I mean, are you just raising this or something, or
is it? So it's not a. If we go down the 90-day path.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine.
Yeah. It was, but that was part of the point. Is if you've got a limit of 90 days, you are still, and if you perceive there to be a difference in terms of residential character between someone, a visitor occupying a house or the owner occupying the house, then in terms of if the latter is sort of getting a bigger tick, if you like, then that's in accordance with, that does fall square.
And then just to the question that I asked previously about sort of a practical level, both in implementation and drafting and implementation, how restricted discretionary activities, which are often very focused on the particular effects of a proposal and often get quite narrowly considered, how we can be assured that an RDA could adequately address cumulative effects of multiple RBAs that might exceed 90 days, which is then anything up to 365 days a year in an area.
Yeah. Okay. I'd firstly go back a step and say before you embark upon what would that look like, the first question is, so is there any evidence of there being a cumulative effect?
Well, we have heard from various people about that. Yes, most of the streets, say, or most of the cul-de-sac are bought up by some of these investment properties.
Yeah.
A bus comes and drops seven lots of people off at seven houses every night for 365 days. Now, I'm not probably exaggerating, but they could.
Yeah. And we had an example this morning with a block of units.
And if you're the only person living in that street, it's quite disruptive.
Yes.
And the amenity is very different to living in it.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. And that's where one of the things I did talk about in my evidence was about not allowing buses to come as part of those sort of standards. So that's not, because you are moving into purely visitor accommodation rather than residential visitor accommodation.
To clarify, certainly instances we've been talk about in front of us, shuttle buses rather than bus
like. Yes.
So they still fall into the light vehicle
category. Yeah, and I mean they would fall into the definition of RVA, but because they're more than 90 days, they might need a resource consent, which in this case, your proposition would be restricted discretionary.
Yeah.
But it's a house, in terms of it being a residential unit, it would still come within the RVA definition.
Well, it seems to me, as Ms. Harvey's pointed out, that there is no reason why you couldn't craft a matter of assessment, which basically, for your RDA, your matter of assessment would be any cumulative effects on the residential character and amenity of the residential area in which the activity is proposed,
you're still recommending that as a standard, even within the 90-day
yes.
rule?
Yes. Yes.
And so for a permit of less than 90 days, so only two person per bedroom is the maximum occupancy.
Yeah. And bear in mind that if, you know, and I know mothers from personal experience as well, if you own a batch, I mean, you know, you often have a 10 on the lawn for the kids and you've got the place chock and block, but this is, and that's just doing it your own thing. But if you, in terms of it being other people coming in, then those controls can apply in terms of those rules. And so, and if that's the case, you potentially have less effects on the residential character associated with visitor accommodation than would necessarily with an own occupied scenario.
I'm more interested in how the sort of effects on, you know, whether you have to rely on being able to identify some sort of tipping point under an RDA to say, well, once a certain proportion of the street became investor-led 365-day-a-year visitor accommodation, and the effects on that on residential cohesion and amenity generally, rather than worrying just about parking or...
No, I appreciate that that is actually, it's quite a difficult thing, and it would be a matter of fact and circumstances in each case. But as I pointed out in my evidence, that the corollary of that, of having a whole lot of streets that are permanently empty, is you know, that sort of the more ghost town type, you know, scenario is not actually providing residential cohesion either. It's just the other end of the
Can I play the devil's advocate and suggest that that would be the status quo?
Yeah.
When I first arrived in Wanaka, the status quo was 40% that has a rent.
Yeah, well, Taupo's my hometown, and there's many streets you drive around there where entire streets are on holiday homes.
Well, potentially there's your residential amenity.
Well, that is a certain form of residential amenity, you're right, but the point is that there's no residential activity occurring there, they're just empty houses for much of the year.
But I mean, it's not. I mean, like, sure, okay, that's a problem. Potentially a problem.
Yeah.
Could be a problem. We have no evidence that that's actually a problem. No one's come along and asked us that that's a problem.
I'm not saying it's a problem.
well, we certainly haven't had any evidence
yeah.
that it's a problem. But we have had evidence. We have had evidence that the flip side is of a concern, even for people who are offering residential visitor accommodation in their own homes. They're saying they wouldn't like to see. They don't like to see the situation where people are buying up houses as investments. They're not holiday homes. They're not people living in their house using it for short-term accommodation as well. And they're becoming a pseudo visitor accommodation, but in the guise of RPA.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say something on that. That when we originally heard about this kind of activity where you have the minibus or the bus showing up and people filing out. That was news to me because it's not kind of our market.
It's not your market at all.
And so I kind of wonder whether I'd love to know the scale of that. What we did attempt to do in our submission was to look at that specifically, and that's kind of where in our submission the idea of unrelated parties or having a single party occupy, so you couldn't take your multiple couples and cram them into a holiday home. So we did actually try to address that in the original submission, and I think some of that thinking has probably percolated through to what council's come back with. But I sort of have a feel for how big an issue that actually is, or whether it's just anecdotal when people are sensitive to it. But I would have thought there would be some way, whether it's identifying, you know, vehicle movements, types of vehicles, you know, there should be something that could be done to isolate that activity. And not impact, you know, the core sort of batches and holiday home, family, group travel experience, which is what we've been doing for years.
It's a good time to use the fresh coffee and into us, so we'll take a 10-minute break.
Yeah, sure.
You know what they are.